Well, good afternoon. So we're picking up with our 17th book. As I said in my little introductory email, we've really covered the sequential narrative of history going from creation, Genesis, all the way through the growth and rise and fall of the nation of Israel into captivity. And then in Ezra and Nehemiah, we really had the post-captivity, where you've got your 70 years, and then you've got the five different Persian kings that we know about, and what key events took place in their rules. The first one being with Cyrus in his first year, when Zerubbabel, the prince of Judah, leads the first batch back to Jerusalem to start rebuilding the temple. And then later, you've got the completion of the temple, and then after that is when Ezra and Nehemiah come on the scene in Jerusalem and finish rebuilding the city walls. So we don't exactly know how long that period is, but for our purposes today, having gotten to, you know, kind of that sort of big framework, now the rest of the books in the Old Testament, we're going to start going back at various intervals and plugging in additional information and details. So the book of Esther actually is going to take place within the reigns of those Persian kings. Ezra chapter 4, verse 7 lists off a series of kings, and the second one after Cyrus is named Ahasuerus. And it's during his reign that Esther is going to be, you know, taking place. And so in our context, Zerubbabel has led them back to Jerusalem. So the Jews have started to repopulate Judah and Jerusalem. They started to rebuild the temple. Construction is ongoing. So we're quite a few years down the road from the captivity. We're not exactly sure how many. So you have the 70 and then Cyrus's reign, and now we're here in Ahasuerus. So to give an overview of the book, get to sum it up in a sentence, you know, I'd say that even though God is not expressly mentioned once in the book, his providential care and direction of events is clearly seen as he delivers the Jews from annihilation. There's a plot against them for their total extinction, extermination, and God is definitely moving the people and the events, even to details as small as a night's sleep, to work things out just how he wants it. But it's definitely behind the scenes. Who is our writer? No idea. I don't have any clues on that. Our time period, as we just said, takes place during the reign of the Persian Empire. So after Persia's already conquered Babylon, so we're past the 70 years in Babylon, and then after the reign of King Cyrus of Persia, we're into the next king, Ahasuerus. So while the temple is being reconstructed in Jerusalem, the events are actually going to take place in the Persian city of Shushan, which is the capital of Persia. All right. So picking up with our chapter by chapter, we really get the backstory for why does Esther come on the scene at all. And that starts with Queen Vashti. She disobeys the Persian king. And this starts in the third year of Ahasuerus' reign. So again, we don't have precise years of from when the captivity was, but we can keep track of things by using the years of the king's reign. So we're starting in year three. So we learn a little bit about Ahasuerus in this chapter and the Persian Empire. One is that the Persian Empire is huge. It stretched from India all the way across the Middle East, all the way to Ethiopia, which is in Africa. So it had 127 provinces. And it is the center of the empire, or the capital, is located in the city of Shushan. Modern-day maps would call it Susa, and it's about 225 miles to the east of Babylon, so even farther away than the city of Babylon. So Ahasuerus has been on the throne. He's in his third year, and apparently he's very pleased with himself, and so he decides to have a big party. He invites all of his nobles and his princes, and this party, the feast, goes on for 6 months. It's a 180-day feast with just the important people. After that, they have a week-long feast that includes everybody in the capital city, whether you're a peasant or noble, everybody's included. And it's during this second feast, this week-long feast where everyone's in attendance, that King Ahasuerus sends word to his queen, who's really pretty. He would like her to appear at the feast to show off, you know, how pretty she is. But she refuses to come. She disobeys. The king is quite embarrassed, angry, to say the least. Not only him, but also his, you know, courtiers or his nobles, those who are sitting there with him. And they decide this is going to cause problems across the kingdom, that, you know, if the queen can disobey her husband, the king, then, you know, all the wives across the kingdom, you know, will show disdain to their own husbands. And so they come up with a plan. Here's the plan. First, Vashti's going to be fired. She can't be queen anymore. Someone else should be chosen to replace her. Then they're also going to send out a royal decree throughout the whole kingdom, basically reinforcing the order or ordering all the wives in the whole kingdom that you need to honor your husbands. Don't follow Vashti's example, basically. And so try to, you know, nip in the bud what they saw was the conflict that was coming because of Vashti. And they didn't want the wives across the kingdom to hold their husbands in contempt. All right. So that's chapter one. So we've got the conflict of what set it up. Sometime later, we don't know exactly when, but sometime after this, we know the king's anger has been appeased. He's no longer upset about it. But he remembers what Vashti's done. So she's already been kicked out from being queen at this point. It's at this time that his servants make the suggestion, you know, we ought to go ahead and get looking for that queen. So we're going to do a nationwide search for all the best looking virgins in the whole kingdom, you know, massive kingdom from India to Ethiopia. We're going to find the prettiest girls and they can come test them out to see who you want to select as your queen. And then in verses 5-7, we're introduced to one of our main figures. There's a Jew named Mordecai. He was a Benjamite. We don't know much more about him. We get some of his ancestors there. But we know that either he or his ancestors were carried away during the capture of King Jehoiachin. He was the 19th king of Judah. So this is not that final captivity when everyone went to Babylon and when Jerusalem was destroyed. This is the one immediately before that. It was 11 years before that. Jehoiachin and 10,000 people from Jerusalem were taken in kind of this first captivity wave from Judah. So either he or his ancestors were carried away during that. Now I say it could be his ancestors because this is a long time that's passed since then. So you've got 11 years before the captivity plus 70 years for the captivity period. And then you've got the entire reign of King Cyrus, however long that is. So you're looking at Mordecai would at least have to be in his 90s if it's referring to him, if it wasn't referring to one of his father or grandfather. So not exactly sure, but that's how much time has passed. And then we learn that he took his orphaned first cousin, Esther, into his own home to raise as his daughter. Now, I had always assumed and heard that Mordecai was Esther's uncle. That's actually not so. If you go look at the verses, it says that she was the daughter of Mordecai's uncle. So the daughter of your uncle would be your first cousin, so your father's brother. So she actually had two names, and I can't say the Jewish name, Hadassah, but her Persian name was Esther. It's significant that she had a Persian name because her race as a Jew is kept secret for a long time. So they didn't refer by the name that would have given it away, so she goes by her Persian name. So Mordecai, when Esther was orphaned, her parents were dead, he took her into his home and raised his cousin as his own daughter. So, all that being said, you've got this nationwide search going on for the prettiest ladies to be potentially the new queen. Esther gets chosen as one of them. And so she is brought to the king's house along with all the other virgins that they found, and they have to start going through a 12-month purification process. So you got 6 months with some smelly goodness and some 6 months of another smelly goodness they put on you. And I think the practical reason, they make sure you're not pregnant so there's no potential heirs of, you know, coming in under the king. And then, during this process, before Mordecai is taken, he commands Esther not to reveal to anyone that she's a Jew, so she obeys. And then the actual process for the king selecting the queen is that each of these virgins, after they've gone through a 12-month process, would get a one-night opportunity to please the king. That's exactly what it sounds like. And then they would go to the house of concubines, and she would only come back to the king if he specifically called her by name. Okay, so they're going through the selection and all these are going on. Well, time passes. Apparently this takes a while. So because it's not till year seven, remember we're back at year three, that Vashti made her mistake. So year seven is when a new queen is actually selected. He actually selects Esther to be the new queen. That's verses 15 through 20. He was well pleased with her. She's appointed as the new queen. The king hosts a feast in her honor. And it's from this point that her cousin Mordecai begins to sit in the king's gate on a regular basis. Now, before she had been queen, he had been walking out beside where the royal women's chambers were. Can you get a little bit closer there to try and figure out what's going on with her, make sure she's okay, see how she did. But now that she's queen, this is the spot where he sits up, and he sits there on a regular basis. And so, interestingly enough, one of the days while he's sitting in the king's gate, you think this would be like the entryway to the palace, he learns that two of the king's own chamberlains, which are, you know, pretty important servants, and he had seven that were noted, two of the top, you know, seven, decide they're really upset with the king and they want to kill him. So Mordecai, hearing their plan, sends word to Esther. She then tells the king about the plan, and she tells him, that it was Mordecai who told me. You know, so she gives him the credit. King promptly has the matter investigated. They confirm the conspiracy exists, and the conspirators are promptly hung. And then they write down, and this is significant, they write down in the chronicles of the Persian kings, you know, this is like the event book, the diary of the important things that happened to the king, they write down that Mordecai had done this service. And then we move on from there. We don't hear anything else about that for a while. Time passes. So we were in year seven when she becomes queen. Jumping forward in verses 1 through 6 of chapter 3, we're introduced to a new guy. His name is Haman. He's described as an Agite, and Haman is growing in power and influence under the king. The term Agite, I did a word search for the root word of Agite, and came up with only one entry, and that was King Agag of the Amalekites. Now, you may not remember the Amalekites, but they were the people that God sent Saul out to destroy, but Saul failed to completely destroy all their stuff, including the king, and Samuel actually had to kill Agag. And this was one of the reasons that God rejected Saul for his disobedience. So possibly this is the descendant of Agag of the Amalekites, or it could be some other reference that I don't know. But you can go see in 1 Samuel 15 to see about that episode with Saul and King Agag. So Haman, he's promoted. He keeps working his way up the kingdom. He gets to second in command of the whole Persian Empire. And so he's an important dude, and the king has given a decree that, you know, everyone who sees him is supposed to show him reverence. That he's important. However, every time he passes by the king's gate, Mordecai, the Jew, doesn't bow, doesn't prostrate himself, doesn't even step out of the way, disobeying the king's command. And this infuriates Haman, so much so that he decides that just taking revenge on Mordecai is insufficient to assuage his anger. It's insufficient revenge, so he determines that he should cause the extermination of all of Mordecai's people, the Jews. He said, I'm going to kill them all because he's offended me. All right? So in the 12th year, so we're now 5 years after Esther's been made queen, in the 12th year of Ahasuerus' reign, Haman starts putting his plan into action. And specifically, this is the first month of the Hebrew calendar. Sometimes it's referred to as Abib, sometimes Nisan. Either way, first month of the Hebrew calendar. And so it says that he put his plan into action to exterminate the Jews. And it used the expression, the lot was cast. So I think about like rolling the dice. He's taking his chance, trying to see if it'll come out his way. And the word lot, it's going to come up later. So just hang on to that. But so to start his plan, he goes before the king and he starts slandering the Jews, saying, you know, king, there are people within your kingdom. They don't obey your laws. They keep, you know, they keep themselves separately. And, you know, really, they're just going to cost you trouble. It really would be for your benefit just to wipe them out. And tell you what, I will volunteer 10,000 talents of my own silver, which is a whole lot of money, to exterminate this people. Just for context, there were a couple of talents given to a servant of one of the prophets, and they had to have two servants to carry a talent. So heavy, heavy amount of silver, so big dollars that he's contributing to try to cause the Jews to be wiped out. King Ahasuerus says, okay. He agrees with the plan. He gives him the king's ring and says, send out letters, and you can seal them with this ring, and so everyone knows that they're authentic and, you know, have the force of a royal decree. And so Haman does. He sends out the letters, and the letters say, all right, everybody, here's the plan. 11 months from now, on the last month of the year, on the 13th day, we're going to kill all the Jews. Prepare yourself. All right, you got 11 months to get ready. And then the letters were sealed with the imprint of that king's ring, which he'd given to Haman. So in chapter 4, the news spreads. Mordecai and all the Jews in the province of all the Persian kingdom, they hear about it. And they rend their clothes, which means they rip their clothes. They put sackcloth, which is like, you know, think of burlap sacks or like flour sacks that are rough, on his clothing. And they put ashes on their head, and they mourned and fast and wept loudly. Now, all of these are common manifestations through the Old Testament of people who are sad and who are grieving and seeking after God. You know, so God's not mentioned here, but this mourning and fasting, weeping loudly, is they're weeping to God. It's not just, you know, crying out in general. So even though it's not written, that's your context of what's going on. So Esther apparently doesn't know about Haman's plan or the proclamations or the letters. All she hears is that, you know, the guy who's raised her as her father, her first cousin, is out wailing in the streets in sackcloth. And she's really distressed by this. He can't come into the king's gate wearing that. And so he's outside the street. So she sends someone out with some clothes to put on Mordecai. Mordecai says, no, I don't want him. What he was wearing was intentional. So Esther winds up sending a second messenger out to say, what is wrong? What's troubling you? And Mordecai winds up relaying to the messenger all that's going on and even gives a copy of the proclamation letter for Esther to read. And then he says, Esther, you've got to beg the king on behalf of the people and get him to change his mind. Now, Esther comes back with a very practical response. And she says, everyone knows that you can't just go before the king uninvited, because if you do that, the penalty is death, unless he elects to pardon you on the spot by raising his golden scepter to you that says, okay, I'm not going to kill you because you came in uninvited. And, you know, very, very practical. She's fearing for her life. Mordecai responds, and I've got this in italics. Anytime I use italics in this, it's a direct quote. I'll give you the citation at the end. It says, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So he's saying, you know, don't think that just because you're a queen, you're not going to be destroyed along with the rest of us. That, you know, God's going to deliver us. And he doesn't specifically reference God again. God's going to deliver us from some avenue if it's not you. But if he does, he's going to destroy you and the rest of your father's house for your unwillingness to trust him and follow after. And then he really asks the question, this may be the exact reason of why you were raised into the position of being the queen. So Esther, hearing that, says, okay, I've got a request. Mordecai, you get all the Jews in the capital city of Shushan, and y'all fast. And again, there's implies pray. Fast and pray for 3 days, while she and the ladies who are on the inside of the palace do the same thing. And she said, then afterwards, she's going to go. She's going to present herself unlawfully before the king. And then kind of cryptically, she says, and if I perish, I perish. That's a real possibility that it could have cost her life to appear. So chapter 5 picks up with Esther going before the king, uninvited. But as you know, he spares her life, extending his golden scepter towards her. So the king asks Esther, you know, what would you like? What's your petition? Well, obviously something's important going on. If you're willing to risk your life to show up uninvited, what would you like? Esther only says, I would like you, king, and your number two, Haman, to join me for a banquet that I've made ready for you that day. And so the king says, okay. And so the king and Haman show up at the banquet. Turns out it's a banquet of wine, other things. Wine's the only thing mentioned. And so while he's there, the king asks Esther again, what would you really like? What do you want from me? What's your petition? Again, knowing that she probably didn't risk her life just to invite him to supper, which could have been arranged through, you know, many other channels. Esther politely responds, she would like the king and Haman to join her for another feast tomorrow. And she promises then that she'll tell the king what she really wants. So you can imagine Haman, who's quite vain and proud of himself, is really pleased that he's being included in these really special and exclusive feasts. Three people feast, king, the queen, and me. And he's going home with a glad heart and really excited about it. And, you know, he's coming back tomorrow for the next one until he passes Mordecai. Mordecai doesn't stand up, doesn't bow, doesn't show him any form of respect. And it just infuriates him. So when he gets home, Haman calls his wife and his friends and proceeds to boast about all his wealth and power and position of influence in the kingdom. But then finally he admits at the end that all of it is spoiled because of that Jew Mordecai and that he's not showing him respect. So his wives and friends give him a suggestion. They say, you know, you ought to build gallows where you hang people, right? Build gallows on your property that day and build it 50 cubits tall. And the cubit's a measurement from basically your wrist to your elbows. It's about 18 inches. So we're talking 75 feet tall. This is making a very big statement. Build that on your property so you can hang Mordecai on it the following day. You just need to go ask the king's permission. And you're number two. He's not going to turn you down, right? So seeing God moving in the scenes in chapter 6, that night after that first banquet, Ahasuerus can't sleep. And so while he's there, he calls for someone to read to him the Chronicles of the Kings of Persia. Now, I would think that'd be a pretty good way to fall asleep. That sounds pretty boring. However, given that the time that they're reading about was during his own reign, he might have been very interested. And so they're reading about the time 5 years earlier. Remember, we're in year 12, and it was back in year 7 that Mordecai had prevented the plot against the king's life. They read that little notation about Mordecai, you know, revealing the plot, sparing the king's life. And King Ahasuerus asked the question, What have we done to thank him, to show him honor for the service that he's done to the king? And the guy reading the book has to say, nothing. You know, we haven't done anything. And so it's at that moment that Haman is coming into the court, and he's coming with the intention of asking for Mordecai's life so he can hang him. He's going to come up with all slanders. You know, he's disobeying you for not showing me reverence, whatever. And the king, you know, invites Haman in, and he says, you know, I've got a question for you. In your opinion, what would be the best way to honor someone? When I want to honor somebody, what should I do to honor them? Now, Haman, being so vain as a peacock, thinks, well, who could the king want to honor more than myself? You know, he's number two in the kingdom. So he makes the suggestion about what he would really like. And so he says, well, the man that you want to honor, you should first put him in your royal clothing and then let him ride on your royal horse. And then have that horse be led around through the city by one of your most noble princes. And that noble prince needs to be shouting, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. King tells Haman, yep, that sounds like a good idea. I want you to go do all those things right now to Mordecai the Jew. Haman, you can just imagine the blood falling out of his face, but he obeys. He immediately obeys his king. And he's leading him through the city, you know, hollering and, you know, heaping praise upon him as the king commanded. But immediately after he's done, he rushes home with his head covered, and he's humiliated by this turn of events. And his wives and friends, who had, you know, the previous day told him that, you know, you should hang that Jew, now tell him, if Mordecai really is the seed of the Jews and you've begun to fall against him, you're not going to prevail. And it's at that moment while they're talking that the king's servant arrives at Haman's house and says, yo, Bubba, it's time to go to Esther's second feast. Let's go. So chapter 7 picks up with Haman's at the feast. And once the king and Haman are both there, Ahasuerus, the king, asks Esther once again, what is your request? What is it you really want? He says, ask up to half of my kingdom and I'll give it to you. What do you want? And so this time Esther tells him. She says, I would like my own life and the lives of my people who are going to be destroyed by an enemy. Now, Ahasuerus has got to be just shocked that someone is daring to threaten the life of his queen. So he asks, who would think to do such a thing? And, you know, with that softball teed out, Esther points to Haman as an adversary, and the enemy is this wicked Haman. And so the king is just livid. He has a burst of anger and he leaves the room just in a storm. He goes out in the garden. Haman, seeing that he's in mortal danger and that the king has got evil thoughts towards him, against him, he attempts to beg Queen Esther for his life. And so he falls upon the bed, which also could be a sofa, where Esther has been sitting. And it's that moment that after the king comes back in and sees the scene, but rather as interpreting that as, you know, Haman prostrated himself to beg for his life, he interprets it that Haman's about to rape Esther. And he's like, is he really going to do that with me right in the house? And so he immediately orders Haman's arrest. And the word hadn't gotten out of his mouth. Well, the hoods came down and they cover Haman away, or drag him away with his head covered. And one of the chamberlains pops up and says, he just built some really tall gallows to hang Mordecai the Jew, the guy who helped you. And the king says, well, that'll work. Go hang him there. So they do. So in chapter 8, you get kind of the wrap-up of the king gives all the property that had been formerly owned by Haman to Queen Esther. It's at this time that Esther first reveals who Mordecai is to her, that he's like a father, and that she's a Jew as well. I mean, obviously from the revelation. So Mordecai is called before the king. The king gives him that same ring that he had given to Ahasuerus, that Ahasuerus had given to Haman, so he can write letters on the king's behalf. And Esther takes all the property that she'd been given that had been Haman's, and she puts Mordecai in charge of it. So he's going to be like her steward or overseer. And then Esther begs the king, please reverse the decrees. Everything that had been written by Haman, can you reverse them so the Jews are not going to be destroyed? Now, he doesn't do that. What he does do is he says, Esther and Mordecai, you have my permission to write whatever you want to the Jews and seal it with this ring. Because whatever is written by the king cannot be reversed by anyone. So that was a unique feature of the laws of the Medes and Persians. You see that in the book of Daniel when King Darius is tricked about making that decree that no one should make any prayers to anyone but the king for 30 days, and Daniel prays to God. And then when the king realizes that Daniel's going to be thrown in the lion's den, he doesn't have the power to change his own decree. So under the laws of the Medes and Persians, no one can change a command of the king, not even the king himself. Okay? So Haman's letters couldn't just be canceled, so they had to go at it from another tact. So what they did was they wrote new letters. And these letters were directed to all the Jews. And they said, you have the explicit permission of the king to gather yourselves together in whatever city you're in, and you have the right to fight and destroy your enemies. And not only that, you can take their stuff as your spoils. And you're going to do it on the 13th day of the 12th month. So this is the third month of the year the new letters are going out. So about 9 months from now, get ready. They've already got evil against you, which you now have permission to fight against them. So after the letters go out, Mordecai winds up being promoted within the kingdom. He's clothed with royal clothing, which makes the citizens of the capital really happy. And all the Jews around the whole empire start rejoicing because they've received these letters. And it says that many people actually became Jews. And so they converted to Judaism and started worshiping God like the Jews because the fear of the Jews fell on them. So again, you've got these references and expressions that all point to God, but they don't explicitly mention his name. Mm-hmm. So in chapter 9, you fast forward the 9 months, and you get the fallout. What happens? So you're in the 12th month of the year, finally, and this is the month Adar. And for our calendar, that would be February, March time of year. So on the 13th day, when everything had been planned, both the attack and the defense, all the Jews gather together in their respective cities, and they fight. They fight against all those, their enemies, and those that wanted to destroy them. And it says no man was able to stand before them. So God's obviously aiding their efforts. In addition to God, the local deputies, officers, lieutenants of the king actually get in the fight, and they fight on the Jews' behalf. And part of the reason is that is because Mordecai, who keeps getting promoted up in the kingdom, they know he's a prominent Jew, and they fear him. And so rather than tick off him, they help the Jews defend themselves. And Mordecai continues to grow stronger and stronger in the kingdom. Eventually, he's going to be up at the same spot that Haman was as the number two. Verses 6 through 15 of chapter 10 zoom in on just the capital city. The Jews fight, defend themselves. They kill 500 men plus all 10 sons of Haman. But they don't take anyone's property as spoil. And that's a pattern you see when they're given the list of everywhere that they fought. They don't take the property. They just defend their lives. So the king calls Esther in and he tells them, here's the body count. The Jews had a great victory today. They've killed 500 men. Is there anything further that you'd like? And she says, yes, two things. I would like the sons of Haman to be hung upon the gallows. And this used to confuse me. Like, well, how are they hanging them? Because they're already dead. So they were killed them. I think they're hanging up their bodies. And I think they're making a point. So hang the 10 sons of Haman on the gallows, and then also authorize the Jews to fight against their enemies here in the capital for one more day, tomorrow as well. King says, okay. So the sons are hung, and then with the king's permission, the Jews fight the next day as well, and they kill an additional 300 of their enemies that are there within the capital. So that's the 14th day of Adar, the 12th month. And then in verses 16 through 19, you kind of zoom out and you get the picture across the whole kingdom that the Jews killed a total of 75,000 people who had wanted to destroy them, you know, operating in self-defense. And again, they didn't take any of their enemies' property as spoils. So around the kingdom on the day after the fight, so everyone fought on the 13th day. On the 14th day, all around the kingdom, they had this massive celebration, feast, and it was a really good time. Everywhere except for the capital. They had asked for an extra day to fight. So they fought there for 2 days, and then they celebrate on the day after that, which was the 15th. And all that leads up to why the date's being so specific, because there's a new feast called Purim, which is going to be celebrated from this point forward by the Jews. Verses 20 through 32 sets out Mordecai sending letters to all the provinces establishing that all the Jews should keep a feast on the 14th and 15th day. So those are the 2 days they celebrated, the 14th in the provinces and the 15th in the capital of the 12th month, to remember the deliverance by God from the hand of Haman, who had cast the lot against their life. So he rolled the dice against their life. And so Pur means lot. And so Purim is the feast of Lot. And so he wrote this letter, you know, establishing this feast. And then later, Queen Esther sent a second round of letters confirming, saying, yes, all that Mordecai set out regarding Purim is true, and you need to do that. And then in chapter 10, it's just real short, 3 verses. One, you get Ahasuerus taxed all his lands and even the islands of the sea. Not sure your significance there, but that's what happened. All right. Verse 2, the rest of the acts of his greatness, the king, Ahasuerus's, and the greatness of Mordecai are recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia. So that was what the king was being read to that day. And then in verse 3, Mordecai, we find out, rises until he's second in command of the whole Persian Empire. It's kind of a parallel with Joseph, right? It says, for Mordecai the Jew was next unto King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth or benefit or prosperity of his people, and seeking peace to all his feet. And that's the book of Esther.